Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to chat with author John Rachel, and he's going to talk about his book, The Man Who Loved Too Much. Welcome, John.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you today?
Well, it's the middle of the night here in Japan, so it's pretty dark, actually. And my wife is upstairs sleeping, so it's very calm here.
Well, you can go back to sleep after the interview.
Well, I'll try not to sleep during the interview. If I don't answer a question, just yell and wake me up.
For our audience, why don't you tell them a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan, and so the first thing that people ask is the new book, The Man Who Loved Too Much, autobiographical? And yes, there's a lot drawn from my growing up there. Some of my earliest memories are some of the very questions that my main character asks. Like, there must be something better than this. How do I get out of here? And then I went to university. I spent most of my life after that working in the music business. I've been a music producer, songwriter, audio engineer. And my last 10 years in America were up until 2006. And I had a beautiful home in Portland, Oregon, and a recording studio and a staff. And we did record production and radio promotion. And then it all fell apart. And I said, you know, I've been dreaming all my life about traveling the world, and this is one of those rare opportunities where everything has disintegrated, so I have nothing to lose by just, giving it a shot. So I left on August 3rd, 2006, and I traveled around the world for a whole year, doing something called woofing, which is worldwide opportunities in organic farming, and caught the travel bug, and I haven't looked back. I'm somewhat settled here in Japan, but I have a lot of flexibility here because I love the Eastern cultures, and so it's not unusual for me to pop down to Vietnam or Cambodia or Thailand or wherever, just to sample a little different flavor of Asia.
That's interesting. So you travel a lot, even though you're based in Japan now.
Well, I'm based in Japan because I got married 3 years ago, but I've been in 26 countries. I've traveled through and lived in, meaning I lived in India for 6 months. I lived in Vietnam for 6 months. I lived in Nepal for 3 months. So I like to travel, kind of unusual for somebody my age, but I love the backpacking style. I love to go into these guest houses and youth hostels and so forth and just get to know people. A lot of times when I travel alone, I do the whole bunk bed thing, in a room full of six or eight other people. And it's just a fascinating way to see the world. And when I settle in, I settle in. Like in Vietnam, I had my own little apartment and cooked all my own food, went down to the market every day and got my vegetables and stopped at the bakery and picked up my bread. And I like to live with people and see how they live, what they think, what similarities there are to, Western culture and what differences.
That must be really interesting because it's like anthropology. You're just like trying to see what the study of man is. That's really cool.
Yeah, I have, like I say, when I was a boy, I used to lay on the floor and look through these maps, trying to remember where all the countries were. And I had dreamed all my life of going to this continent called Africa. When I was a boy, Africa was just this big black ink spot on the world map. I mean, literally, they didn't even bother to write in the countries. And I said, well, I have to go there. I know that there's gorillas and lions and elephants and stuff there, but there has to. So that was part of my first year. I went to Uganda, lived there for four and a half months. I was in Kenya and South Africa. And I'd like to go back to Africa. It's a fascinating place. And the people are just so incredibly warm and so wonderful. It's amazing there.
That sounds really cool. I always wanted to go someplace like that, but never had a chance. So that's really nice to live vicariously through it. I mean, that's one of the reasons I love to read books about stuff like that and watch movies, because in a way you're vicariously living through someone else's imagination. That's one of the cool things about being a writer, too. You get to go places that you've never been.
Yeah, that's true. You get to go places that you could not possibly go, you know?
Oh, yeah, especially write science fiction.
I mean, I've had some what would you call it, kind of dodgy experiences along the way, but people always ask me, you know, aren't you afraid? Aren't you afraid they're going to chop your head off or something? And to be honest with you, and I'm not denigrating America in any way, but I have only been in one country where I felt as threatened as I typically felt in America, and that was South Africa. South Africa is a very, very contentious, still very troubled place with a lot of tension between blacks and whites. And I got robbed there, but it was actually kind of a pleasant experience, believe it or not. But every other country I've been in, most of the countries you can't own guns, you know. So if somebody pickpockets you or holds you up, they just take your, you know, your 20 pesos and they leave. They don't shoot you. So it's a different level of exposure to crime, you know.
Okay, you got my interest. How does being robbed become a pleasant experience?
Well, I was in a guest house in Johannesburg, and it was a very mixed. There was a mixed black and white, and there were some people from Zambia there. And I love dancing, so we all got together as a group and went to the closest town. And the closest town was 100% black, so all the clubs were full of black people, and we kind of stood out. Anyway, we're dancing, having a great, good old time. I'm feeling pretty good. I'm not going to say I was drunk, right? I'm feeling pretty good. I started wandering around the bar, and all of a sudden this man started coming toward me. He had this big, round, cherubic face, but he himself was the size of a mountain range. I mean, his neck was the size of my waist. This guy was enormous. So anyway, he comes up to me, literally comes up to me, and he wraps his arm around my neck, and I'm laughing because I think he's just being funny. And he holds me for about 30 seconds and then whaps me on the back and goes on his way. And then I went back upstairs and I found out that all my money was and my cell phone were gone out of my pocket. So while he was giving me this big man hug, he was robbing me. So I just laughed it off, and you know, $20, and now that's how you learn. I had even a stranger experience my very first night, on my year around the world. I was in Madrid. Again, I went out dancing, and I was coming back, and this young man, a wiry young guy, couldn't have weighed more than, you know, 85 pounds, maybe 16, 17 years old, just walking next to me, and he's high-fiving me, hey, Americano, Americano. I don't know how he knew that, but anyway, he threw his leg over in front of me and almost tripped me. And I thought, well, that was weird. And then the next thing I know, like the guy could almost move through space, he was like 20 feet away from me, standing there, and he was holding my wallet up in the air.
Oh, my God.
And He opened the wallet. It was one of those zip wallets. He unzipped it. He opened it. He took my passport. I had everything in there because I was so stupid. He took my passport, threw it on the floor, on the ground in front of him. Took my credit cards, threw it on the ground in front of him. Took my money out, threw my money on the ground. Then threw the wallet on the ground, waved at me, and walked away. I went and picked everything.
That was odd.
Well, it was and it wasn't. In fact, in book two of The Man Who Loved Too Much, I have a scene like that when Billy arrives in New York City. He was telling me, you dumb American, don't walk down the street with all of your stuff in your pocket. There's bad people here. He was teaching me a lesson.
An angel in disguise.
Isn't that a wonderful story?
Yes.
I would have been so screwed. I would have lost my passport, all my everything. I don't know what I would have done, you know. But he was telling
me,
hey, wise up.
You're stupid.
You know, you're walking down the street like a dumb American. Now, wise up. So anyway, I've had a lot of really wonderful things, crazy things happen, and I'm, you know, it's an interesting world.
Have you always been a writer?
I used to, no. And as I say, I used to write songs, used to produce music. Occasionally I would jot down something resembling a story, but nothing serious. When I packed up my recording studio and I packed up my belongings in a garage, obviously I couldn't take my recording studio with me. And I said, I need a creative outlet. And I started writing my first novel while I was traveling. And that's how I got started.
So the music sort of translated into wanting to write stories. I mean, music, songs are stories.
Exactly.
So they're not that far apart.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's a different palette. I mean, paintings are stories. I mean, a good ballet
any
is
art.
A story. Exactly.
Any art form. I think if you're a creative person, that's why you appreciate all the different art forms. At least most people that I know that are creative do, because it's all connected. They're all a form of expression, and you have to appreciate it because it's in your heart.
And you, well, you're a writer, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you also
yeah.
do other
oh,
things?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm an actress, too.
Really? Oh, my goodness. Now, that's something I have no talent for, but it's fascinating.
Well, I sort of gave it up for a while. But you never really give it up. You keep going back. Like, I did a little theater, and I did other things. You can't totally give it up because it's in you. You just, now I'm doing a radio playhouse where I'm writing radio plays, and I'm producing them on the show, and it's coming up in April. And so, yeah, you never give it up. You can't. It's like something
you're
that just...
You're in a great place for that. San Diego is a pretty artsy town, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, my favorite place is the Globe Theater.
Of course. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I have a great fondness for, I love Shakespeare, too, but I love all the plays that they have here. It's just amazing.
Yeah. It's a beautiful theater,
I think it sort of
too.
Got me going again.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like to read? Are you a biography person? Are you do you like literature? Do you like classics? What's your cup of tea?
Well, because I studied philosophy at university, I shy away from classics now. I had a lot of classical reading back then. I read just about everything. I enjoy just a good fast-moving book. I like quirky authors like Tom Robbins. I love Tom Robbins. There's a guy named Stanislaw Lem. You've ever heard of him?
No.
See, Polish science fiction writer, but his stuff isn't, it's not, space zombies and stuff. It's very, very creative and unusual science fiction writing. He's since deceased, but he's just written some fascinating things. He's got one book called One Human Minute, where he sums up everything that's going, how many people are eating hot dogs in any given minute, how many people are, picking their nose. You start adding up the numbers, any activity over 7 billion people becomes monumental in its size and its effect on the energy of the earth. He has another book called The Futurological Congress, which is it's a futuristic novel where everybody is constantly drugged. The environment, the social environment, the ecology is so degenerated. People are so sick that in order to hide how miserable things are, they put drugs in the water supply. And so the government. So everybody is living this.
No, I said ew, not who.
Oh, but everybody's living this fantastic hallucination until this one guy figures out how to get around taking these drugs, and he starts unpeeling the layers and finally gets down, and you get to see what the world actually looks like. It's really it's just a strange, interesting book, I like stuff like
Sounds
that.
Sounds like it.
Maybe that's
really
why
weird.
Maybe that's why I write such weird stuff. I don't know.
I get into modes. I'll read like biographies, or I'll read mysteries, or I'll read science fiction, or read classics, or whatever. But if I fall in love with an author, I want to read everything. I have this focus that is really weird.
So what's your most recent love affair?
I've always been that way, though.
So what's your most recent author love affair? Who have you gravitated?
Right now it's Carrie Greenwood's Miss Fisher, A Murder Mysteries, Franny Fisher.
Really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's very odd because the only way I can get it is on Kindle, because I've looked at every bookstore that I can find in my area and in surrounding areas. I can't find the books, and I really am more of a book girl than a Kindle girl, so it's making me a little crazy.
I know. All this electronics, it's just maddening, isn't it? There's nothing like feel of a great book in your hand.
The sensuality of a book.
And as a writer, you probably spend more than enough time in front of a screen. You don't want to sit down in front of a screen on the beach.
And read.
You know? Yeah. I agree with you.
Exactly.
But, it's the world. And like when I travel, what am I going to do? Carry 80 books in my backpack? I carry them in my computer. It makes it a lot easier. But
yeah, I know. I know. And convenience and all that. But it just... I like the smell of a book, the feel of it in my hand, to curl up with a book. You just can't do that with a device.
You're right. I'm with you 100%.
Because I was talking to one of my fellow authors. I was at a convention this weekend. I was talking to one of my fellow authors, and we were both saying, for convenience sake, I sell my book as, I'm sure you do too, as Kindle and Nook and all that. But, how do you feel about it? Don't you wish that people would buy more books and less electronic stuff?
Well, I wish that because there would be some... I frankly worry about the whole world of knowledge when the electricity goes off or the Earth gets hit by a comet or whatever, it's all going to disappear. It's just going to evaporate in a flash, you know? Whereas a book, you know, I mean, we still go into a cave and we find some ancient documents, some scrolls that are like 3,000 years old. That could be your book, right?
Yours
was destroyed. And they found your book, and they'd go, "Wow, look at this! This is what life was like back then." But it's not going to happen with everything being digitized. It's just going to all evaporate. And it kind of bothers me with emails too, because I spend a lot of time. Somebody writes. I mean, I'm kind of isolated here in Japan, so my email communication is really important to me. And I write, you know, I write detailed emails, and I think, this is all just going to go poof.
Poof.
Think about, you know, like the letters of Dostoevsky or the letters of Danielle Steele or whatever. Jane Austen, whoever.
Jane Austen.
It's not going to exist anymore, you know?
It doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
I mean, there are authors who will write a letter to someone, especially if it's a child or someone who's sick and stuff like that. But those are very special occasions. Most people just send an email.
Exactly.
And it's sad. It's sad. We're losing the beauty of it.
Well, we may end up returning to that eventually, but you know, for now, everything is fast food, you know.
Yeah.
Eat it, forget it.
Kind of reminds me of the time machine in the movie with Rod Taylor when he's in the future and he sees the books and he touches them and he puts his hands in it, they all disintegrate because nobody uses them.
Right, exactly.
And he loses his mind because he gets so angry about all the knowledge that just disappeared.
And the other thing is that, and this happened in the music business too, it's part of the reason I left the music business, it's all been trivialized. Anybody can be an author now. The last statistic I read was that there were over 32,000 books being published every month. Think about that.
Wow. It's true.
32,000.
It's true.
A month. So there's a Shakespeare out there, you know. There's a Walt Whitman, you know. There's a Mark Twain. But good luck finding them, you know.
I know. It's very difficult. It's so competitive. We don't have a lot of time. Do you have any internet events or anything that you'd like the audience to know about, to tune into?
Golly, I don't. But they're certainly welcome to check out my webpage, which is J.D. Rachel, just the letters, jdrachel.com. If you're extremely conservative or easily offended, do not read my blogs because they will enrage you and then I will get more death threats than I already do. But on there are some, you know, some of my travel photos, all the latest news about my books. Book number 2 of The Man Who Loved Too Much just came out. So that's posted on there. And I encourage people to visit that and leave comments because I love the interaction. And unless something is racist or incredibly rude, I approve all comments. So you'll see quite a variety of reactions to things that I've written and posted there.
And you said you have the second book. Do you have anything you're working on now that you can tell the audience about?
Absolutely. Right after I get through this the next week or so, which is, as you know, you're an author, you know when you release a book, there's like 8,000 things to do all at once. When I get through that, I am writing a nonfiction political manifesto about electoral reform. That will come out in May. It's half done. because a lot of my writing is political. And then in July, The Man Who Loved Too Much, Book 3 comes out. And then toward the end of the year, will be released either a very silly book called Sex, Lies, and Coffee Beans, or my thriller about sex slavery and trafficking for prostitution called Petrocelli. So one of those two will come out. Petrocelli is already completely done, but I'm actually shopping it with some different literary agents just to see, because I can't get my fill of rejection letters, you know? I mean, I just, I love them because they're perfect for camping, you know? They're great for starting fires and...
I could wallpaper my whole apartment with the rejection letters I had. This was before the media and stuff like that. When I started by writing poetry and magazine articles, and I have them from Good Housekeeping and Cosmo. They're all over the place. I could put them all over the place.
You could probably build an apartment building with some, you know. Yeah. I know the feeling. But it's fun getting that something from the New Yorker, you know. You get that letter and you go, all right, and you rip it open and it's some form letter that they've copied on their copying machine like 700 times and you can barely even read it because it's just such. And I love the phrase.
Mine were all postcards. Mine were like postcards. And once or twice I got letters, but most of them were postcards.
That's
insulting. It was the same postcard. I got like 20 postcards from Good Housekeeping.
What were you submitting to them? Pornography? Good grief.
No, it was just articles. But I got the articles published. You know, you send it to everything, and then you just hope that the article will get published. I did get them published. I just actually never got it published in Good Housekeeping. That's why I keep bringing it up. Cause
I know.
It was my mom's favorite, and I always wanted to get something in there, never could get it.
I understand.
But it was,
I know
I
exactly.
I think it was because it was very
say,
modern
hey,
woman
this.
Stuff.
Yeah. Too modern.
Yeah. Because I was in my 20s. So it was stuff that I was going through, you know, as a young woman in the business world and going to college. And I guess it was a little there was no, oh, well, look and see what the market is for that. They didn't have that. They didn't even give that in the direction. So I just sent that article to them, too.
Your stuff was too edgy for Good Housekeeping.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Should have sent it to Cosmo.
Oh, I got declined by Cosmo, too. But I got into, I actually had one in Newsweek.
No way! You made Newsweek?
Yeah.
I am in awe. I am really in awe. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was about being at a protest at a nuclear facility.
Ah.
Yeah,
okay.
I actually wasn't. I was just there to observe. One of my friends, she was part of it. She actually had herself chained to the facility that's in Chatsworth.
Wow. All right. So you're hanging with revolutionaries.
It was so funny because I was the most, I've been a knee-jerk liberal my whole life, but I've always been real even-keeled and had friends on both sides of the fence, and I thought it was kind of funny.
That's great, though. I mean, you know, That's a good story. So you are a knee-jerk liberal. Well, good. You can read my blogs.
Yeah.
You'll probably like them.
Yeah, I'm sure I could. Yeah.
But I have
we
a style
that
really...
We are at the end,
really...
John.
Oh, no. All right.
I know. I've
this
enjoyed it.
This has been
it.
Great. Thank
been
you.
A lot of fun.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me, and maybe we can do it again sometime.
Sure, maybe on your next book.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Sherry.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.